This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 68, brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron and Archover. Once again, it's a new year, so this is the once a year episode without a guest, covering the highlights of 2016 and a peep into 2017. I'm also giving out 9 awards for those folks and firms that have really impressed me, and to be honest, that takes some doing. As we are all involved in trying to understand what is going on in the world at large, and in fintech, many of these are media awards. Best Media Outlet of the Year, Best Media Checker, Best Non-Fintech Journalist, Best Fintech Journalist, Best Fintech Newsletter, Best Fintech Networking Group, Best Regulator, Best LFP Stories, and of course, Best Fintech, plus the LFP One to Watch for 2017. Well, that's probably going to be the most succinct intro of the year, so without further ado, let's dive in. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. As I like to start every episode with some good stories, I thought I ought to start with the award for Best London FinTech Podcast Stories Told by Guest, which this year is jointly awarded to Paul Tamala and Rob Jones. Paul Tamala of ACI told a must-hear story, especially if you're a biographer of Ronnie Reagan, of what happened when Ronnie and Nancy Reagan had dinner with him and others in a pub in Baker Street in LFP 060. If you haven't heard that story, I'd really recommend you listen to the 2 minutes of it, and I'll include a link in the show notes. The joint winner was Bob Jones of Blue Motor Corp for his description of what the Cavern Club, where the Beatles became famous in the 60s, was really like, and in particular it stank rather like a urinal where someone was making cheese under it, which is very different from what we tend to hear, but of course far more credible. I looked back at my last year's New Year podcast and I had 2 particular themes, the whole indie theme and the war on truth by the media, which is rather appropriate given how the year turned out. In terms of the indie theme, it's very interesting because I actually don't think in those terms these days of fintechs. Of the fintechs that are going somewhere, they don't really have much of an indie character after all. They seem like finance houses, which I guess is what you'd kind of expect of firms when they're going into the scale-up mode. Indie is also something that tends to apply in non-regulated sectors. You can have independent coffee shops because there's no coffee regulator telling you how to run a coffee shop. There are health and safety rules and that kind of stuff, but they'd follow those anyway. In a totally different sector, that of Eurorack modular synthesizers, if you don't know what one of those is, never mind, there's a tremendously independent vibe going on. On my recent trip to Riga, I was probably the first person ever to visit Erika Synths on Andre Josta. These are 6 people who started about a year or so ago. They've got about 2 dozen products out. And although they're based on this small industrial estate, and by industrial estate, I want you to think of bleak December in Far East Europe, with the cold Baltic and the USSR wreckage still lying around the place, so it's a real industrial estate. And from this small platform, they are incredibly well known in the United States, in Europe, and someone like me actually puts them on the top of their list. So it's an amazing story about how much impact you can have as an indie in the modern world in the case where it's not regulated. Just taking the example of the London FinTech podcast, I noticed, again compared to last year, that I've now had 120,000 more downloads in over 150 countries. If a year ago I was talking about the war on truth by the mainstream media, ironically of course, and this is one we probably all had a giggle at, by the autumn the mainstream media in the United States, alo New York Times and Washington Post, was screaming hysterically about fake news. Rather ironic really, as they're the ones who produce most of it in the first place, along with the BBC, a torrent of corporate and statist propaganda. So let's start with a prize for the Best Media of the Year. Best Media of the Year goes to comedian Russell Brand, who relaunched his Trews program, T-R-E-W-S, on YouTube. He no longer has his jingle at the beginning, but the jingle tells you all you need to know. News is the tool that is abused. Actually, it's a song, but you know, I'm not going to sing it, am I? It's news is the tool that is abused to fool you and to leave you scared and confused. Trews is like the news, if the news was true. I want some trews, let's have some trews. It's much better when they sing it, actually. The main thing that impresses me about Russell Brand is, and occasionally force my daughters to watch it, none of whom particularly like him, is that it's always far more honest, far more accurate, far more truthful than the BBC or ITV mainstream TV news over here. Not only that, it's generally coming from a position of kindness and compassion. I came across in the year the old media baron Lord Beaverbrook's advice to his journalists, saying that he wanted every article they wrote to leave the reader either angry or fearful. Well, that pretty much says it all. So in this world of false news, which definitely exists, I spent a lot of time watching YouTube, and YouTube was full in the autumn of fake news around Julian Assange is now dead. Well, if he is, no one's told him because he seems to be continuing quite well. In this world of false news and fake news, then checking, fact-checking is very important. The Best Media Checker Award goes to Project Censored, which was started in 1976 by Professor Carl Jensen and his Sonoma State University students. The easiest way into Project Censored is to check out their top censored stories of 2015 to 2016. These involve the collective efforts of 221 college students, 33 professors from 18 college and university campuses to produce. I'll read you the top two. Number one most censored story. US military forces are deployed in 70% of the world's nations. If you throw a dart at a world map and do not hit water, Nick Terz reported for Tom Dispatch, the odds are that the US Special Operations Forces have been there sometime in 2015. According to a spokesman for Special Operations Command, in 2015, Special Operations Forces deployed in 147 of the world's 195 recognized nations, an increase of 80% since 2010. The global growth of SOF missions has been breathtaking, Terz wrote. Actually, one thing they don't mention in terms of most censored language is that nobody ever talks about the US empire. Clearly it is a US empire, as those statistics show. The second most censored, although I'd come across this one myself, is the crisis in evidence-based medicine. In April 2015, The Lancet's editor Richard Horton wrote, "Something has gone fundamentally wrong with one of our greatest human creations." Describing the upshot of a UK symposium held that month on the reproducibility and reliability of biomedical research, Horton summarised the case against science. Much of the scientific literature, perhaps half, may simply be untrue. Afflicted by studies with small sample sizes, tiny effects, invalid exploratory analyses, flagrant conflicts of interest, together with an obsession for pursuing fashionable trends of dubious importance, science has taken a turn towards darkness. The apparent endemicity, is there such a word, the apparently endemic nature of bad research behaviour is alarming. That's in science, which of course tries to purport to hold out the truth, but things like pursuing fashionable trends of dubious importance might be applied to fintech, to the blockchain last year. In terms of the best non-fintech journalist, that award is going to be shared jointly between Cassette Boy and Jonathan Pye, both of whom you can find on YouTube. Cassette Boy takes, rather brilliantly, speeches, for example by Theresa May, chops up about a million speeches, puts them back together in a totally false way to produce a new speech. The example with Theresa May on the Snoopers Charter sticks in my mind, as does the Brexit one. And in this ironic world we live in, I'm not sure whether we're post-irony yet, actually the most amazing thing is that although what he's done is completely false and completely fake, because she never gave a speech like that, his art is that actually what he ends up creating, this collage of sound bites or just words, or half of words in some cases, from different speeches, ends up being of a far more deeper truth than anything that Theresa May would ever say. Jonathan Pye is an actor who was unemployed for a couple of years. For those of you who haven't come across him, I'd check him out. And he created a character. Well, actually, the actor's not called Jonathan Pye, but the character's called Jonathan Pye. Jonathan Pye is a TV news reporter, and each episode starts with him doing the last 5 seconds of a kind of, on-camera, normal journalist piece for the TV. And then he sets off in a rant. He shot to fame when one of his acted fake rants was about Donald Trump and the election victory and why he won it. And the interesting thing about this was it's picked up by some US mainstream outlets who said, those damn limeys, they have a much better journalism than we do, because the journalist actually tells the truth about what really happened in our elections and why one won and why one lost. So my awards for best non-fintech journalist this year go to people who are deliberately not telling the truth, but in not telling the truth, they actually tell more truth than those people who tell us they are telling the truth. So the problem we've got around the world, and let's not waste our time discussing it, we've all had our heads done in 2016, is around politics. And I think the problem with politics, we can all see, is that it's the system as a whole. It's the aggregation of power into the state and corporates grows ever and ever larger, and this is then diverted into making not perhaps the 1%, but the 0.1% exponentially richer every year at the expense of everybody else. As Yanis Varoufakis has said, the economic sphere has gained ownership of the political sphere. The fundamental problem I have seen no solution to whatsoever is the world of oligopoly. We have an apparent but no real choice. In the US, as I've been mentioning media, there were 1,500 newspapers, 1,500 TV channels, 9,000 radio stations, all of which are owned by six corporations. Very easy to manipulate those, eh? Hence what we see. There are no obvious difference in the UK between the mobile phone network providers. I've been through the lot and I can tell you there isn't. And then I saw a great infographic over the summer that something like 90% of the food we buy in supermarkets over here is controlled by 10 companies. So this world of oligopoly, which is rapidly where fintech is moving to anyway, how many payments providers do you need, how many P2Ps do you need, is one that we haven't yet learned to control. Moving on to fintech. 2016 was perhaps the year where fintech 1.0 ran out of steam. No one now is predicting that P2P, equity crowdfunding or Bitcoin, for example, will change the world. Well, no one outside the loonies. Plenty of people were predicting that blockchain would change not just the world, but cure Ebola virus and improve your sex life. We're still waiting to see it make an impact on anything. So the brand value of fintech is perhaps worth less than it was. An example of this on last year's shows is R5FX, who now call themselves a market data infrastructure provider instead of a fintech. I'm often asked how to get into the fintech world. It's time to give out the award for Best Fintech Networking Group. I always recommend Eddie George's New Finance. Last year, they passed 10,000 members, held over 50 events, and uploaded 100 videos. An impressive achievement. In 2016, profits became important. I think this was led by Uber pulling out of China the first time they pulled out of anywhere. And in passing, Uber lost an impressive, a phenomenal, $2.2 billion in the first 9 months of 2016. In my review a year ago, I said that regulation would be the challenge in 2016. Plenty of people said to me, no, it won't. They're sweet, these regulators, and they have nice sandboxes and playpens. Think again, sunshine. So, for example, Funding Circle, RateSetter and Zopa, each of whom have lent over £1.5 billion to date, have not yet been authorised. The rules, by the way, came in April 2014, almost 3 years ago. So, for the main course, let's move on to the nine highlights of 2016. Starting with the biggest picture, I'm very pleased and very proud to see that the most downloaded London FinTech podcast episode at the moment is LFP055 with super economist John Kay talking about his book Other People's Money, Masters of the Universe or Servants of the People. Like many of the grey beards, John Kay believes that we have not fixed the problems which led to the explosion or implosion perhaps in 2008 and then it will happen again. In LFP055, he talks about how the financial services system is not serving the people at the moment, what gaps are there, and hence, what the opportunities for fintech to become far more influential, far more important in people's lives and the economy are. It's a must-listen-to episode for anybody who wants to innovate. Moving on to the second topic of policy. I had the great pleasure in LFP065 to talk to Lord Turner, former head of the FSA. Not just former head of the FSA, but something that escaped my recollection. He chaired the Basel committees on Basel III post-2008 in terms of how to put the world back together. Since he is now a retired regulator, and he's written a book as well, Between Debt and the Devil, Money, Credit and Fixing Global Finance, he's had plenty of time to reflect on how things should be. And so I give him my award for the best regulator of the year. After all, as he said, when you're an intellectual and you have time on your hands, you're allowed to think, in a sense, outside the box, to use a cliche, and you're not constrained by the day-to-day necessities. Come back to his views on regulation, but starting with the policy one. The policy one I found very fascinating, especially around the whole deregulation to hyper-regulation that I've seen in my 30 years in finance. The policy process goes along the lines of ideas. These ideas basically hang around until there's fertile ground caused by crises. And then, the third stage is if you've got the political will, we get implementation. In a fascinating example of the free market ideas, he was pointing out that they arose around the time of the Second World War and after the Second World War, when everything, of course, was dominated, not just dominated, completely controlled by the state, as it would be in a world war. And there were plenty of intellectuals at that point said that actually it'd be quite good getting the state off everybody's case. This hung around for a long, long time in the UK until we had the crises of the 70s and then Margaret Thatcher came and implemented them in the 80s. Deregulation, as it was called, although ironically, all the charts that I've ever seen show that she didn't successfully manage to reduce the size of the state. Deregulation itself, of course, led to the process that most of us know by now, where we've ended up in another crisis, 2008. And unfortunately, 2008 is a crisis by and large gone to waste, in that we're not really implementing any new ideas at all. The only ideas we are implementing is this micro-regulation of finance. Infinite number of regulations. I mentioned many times the example of pensions. In the UK, pensions legislation in 1992 was 3,000 pages. It's now 80,000 pages. The only people to benefit are lawyers. The problem in regulation, as Niall Ferguson has said, is that financial regulation has become the disease for which it purports to be the cure. Andy Haldane has said one can't manage complex systems with complex rules. So what did Lord Turner say about this? Lord Turner, having thought about this a lot and having been right at the top, there was nobody higher, said, we should aim for much simpler regulation. I wholeheartedly agree. The core of it should be much more capital. And he said, we need a small number of powerful regulations rather than micro-supervision. Sadly, this is a lesson which is getting lost in fintech. The third sector in 2016 I'd like to focus on, although not in great depth, is payments. Payments is particularly interesting because payments is actually going in the right direction, both in Europe on PSD2, but also in the UK with the payment services regulator. The mandate to open competition is continuing apace and producing some very interesting results. I'll talk about that more in the outlook for 2017, but we'll note in passing that I was rather shocked but pleased to hear Paul Tamala say that one of the drivers behind this is the war on cash, which is a very scary thing. A bit like the euro. The euro was introduced in Europe under the rubric of saving on exchange rate costs. Yeah, sure it did. You didn't have to sell your French francs for pesetas and your pesetas for Deutschmarks. That's absolutely true. But the real motivation wasn't saving tiny sums of money like that. The real motivation was to create this superstate run by an unelected dictocracy, you might call it, perhaps. And the euro we're paying for ever since, and our grandchildren will be paying for it, given how much is borrowed. And the crisis of 2008 is nowhere near finished in Europe. Part 4, peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer had a rather challenging 2016. I mentioned earlier the regulation. It's interesting to note the most recent change, 22nd of December 2016, in an article by Ryan Weeks, who wins my award for the best fintech newsletter for his must-read weekly newsletter on the P2P world. LandBay has become authorised under Rule 36H. In future, only platforms which are fully authorised under Rule 36H will be eligible to accept retail investment. LandBay had to make some changes to their business model, the principal one of which was no longer pre-funding of loans, which is rumoured to be leading to many peer-to-peers thinking of stepping outside retail finance altogether. And to think that a year ago, people were scoffing at the impact of regulation and how it changes things. I hope this isn't some kind of war on retail, as it were. Peer IQ came up with an interesting statistic recently in the States, which has always been more corporatised in the P2P world. In the second half of 2016, 70% of US peer-to-peer loans were securitised. As Kadeem Schuber titled it, online lending has been fully assimilated by the financial borg, which seems an appropriate time to hand out my FinTech Journalist of the Year award. Consistent bravery with a sword of truth cutting through the bullshit and hype with hardcore analysis. Before handing over the award, though, I'd like to see a little less of AbFab in 2017 from those AlphaVille guys. You know AbFab, where the younger generation is more staid and conservative than their parents. Excellent analysis by Kadeem and chums, but it's all too easy to read the FT as a corporate incumbent's tool. The timing of LandBay's authorisation was a little after the FCA released its interim review on loan-based and investment-based crowdfunding. I wish they'd join the rest of the world and just talk about crowdfunding as equities, but never mind. They are a law unto themselves, which is another subject entirely, of course. Let me quote from the review. For both loan-based and investment-based crowdfunding platforms, we have found that, for example, it is difficult for investors to compare platforms with each other or to compare crowdfunding with other asset classes due to complex and often unclear product offerings. It is difficult for investors to assess the risks and returns of investing on a platform. That's one I've said for a long time. Financial promotions do not always meet our requirement to be clear, fair, and not misleading. And the complex structures of some firms introduce operational risks and or conflicts of interest that are not being managed sufficiently. So this was never covered in this particular way, but I thought that was quite a beating, actually. That really was getting a stick out and hammering the sector. It's always being spun in a different direction, of course. One might wonder, perhaps, why, as the regulations were kicked off in 2014, it's taken the regulator over 2 years to come to these conclusions. I was reliably informed by a deep throat source earlier last year that a lot of this is political and actually follows on from Brexit, would you believe it? Post-Brexit, we lost our Chancellor, George Osborne, the architect of Project Fear. Everything was going to be a disaster. He recruited the Governor of the Bank of England in this course to tell us that. Of course, it hasn't been a disaster, and the economy's been growing. Yet another cock-up by economists, say. Or was it just politicians twisting their arms so often? George Osborne was a great fan of fintech and a great fan of peer-to-peer. Originally, as it filled the funding gap caused by increased bank capital requirements, slowing bank lending. And so, when George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer, was fully behind the peer-to-peer and alternative finance sector, it would be rather a brave regulator to go in there and start shooting guns. However, post-George Osborne, I'm reliably informed that the political risk profile has changed dramatically. This perhaps explains the timing of something. Highlight number 5 of 2016 was the episode with Tristan Fletcher on artificial intelligence and machine learning. It's a large, complex episode which many people outside of fintech have found useful for explaining machine learning. I think the predominant takeaway from this is to avoid the phrase artificial intelligence completely. AI tends to be a real marketing tool, real marketing and sales tool, a real hype tool, and be more confusing than anything. After all, we can't define what intelligence is in the human capacity. How can we apply it in the computer domain? So, for example, when I pull up to the petrol station, I fill my car with petrol, I tend to pay with it. Some people fill it with petrol and they drive off without paying with it, and a computer, a camera, however you want to call it, a system, picks up their registration plate. Well, that seems quite clever to me, but is it intelligence? I don't know. Far better, however, to use the phrase machine learning. So what we're talking about in this domain is what can, in a sense, computers do? What can programs that are trained to learn actually learn and regurgitate? And I think what we've seen here over the last 2 years is a lot of the massive hype and massive promises of people to outperforming credits, to understand all these things better than these fuddy-duddy bankers have been proven to be mostly vacuous. I can think of very few examples where people are outperforming. Having said that, these are tools that you absolutely need to know about. And a hot tip for those of you listening earlier rather than later is that I gather on the grapevine that Dr. Tristan Fletcher is more of a free agent than he was when he's on the show, and he's no longer in an executive capacity at Thought Machine. So if you want to snap up somebody that's worked and taught at something like 4 universities and in many, many domains of artificial intelligence, I'd give him a call. Oops, I just said artificial intelligence. Machine learning. My 6th highlight from the 2016 shows is insurance tech. Insurance tech is another one that's been hyped to the skies where we've seen very little. I was very pleased to have Jonathan Howe on the show. He has a lifetime in consultancy services to the insurance industry, 1,000 staff at PwC UK underneath him, and a recent report surveying 1,300 insurtech startups. So he knows roughly more than every journalist, every tech person who's written it up so far. One of the main takeaways for me was his whole enhancement versus disruption. He believes, I think quite rightly, that insurance is not going to be disrupted per se, for the reason that I've always stated, which is that if you go off and say, oh, I want to be a new insurtech, I want to be a cool fintech in insurance, before you know it, you get captured by the insurance regulations, and the insurance regulator comes along and says, no, you're not a cool insurance fintech after all. You're an insurance company. Now, where's your $1 billion of capital, and where's your 10,000 deals to spread the risk? So enhancement versus disruption is really a question that different parts of the value chain are going to be enhanced by fintech insurance. And the other flip side of this is that insurance, and a lot of this actually may end up applying in banking and in asset management and elsewhere, it's less a question of rebels storming the insurance castle than it is of incumbent versus incumbent. Which incumbent assimilates insurtech better than the next will surely have a competitive advantage and move the playing field in that direction. Highlight 7 for me was venture capital. Venture capitalists are treated as very special, but actually most of them aren't special. Most of their investment performance underperforms a monkey. Where they all outperform monkeys, of course, isn't a key skill area of raising funds. In LFP056, Rob Moffat from Balderton Capital joined us to talk about these issues, and I think was quite convincing on the point that the best VCs, however, do add value to their investments by their expertise and bringing connections and insights. I know several folks who have approached Balderton and other VCs since and used his guide on into how to seduce a VC with pretty good effect. Moving on to Section 8, Corporate Governance. Jeff Miller gave a great exposition of why corporate governance isn't just a PC box-ticking exercise, but is something which will enhance the future of all fintechs. So far, we've seen relatively little happening on the non-executive front in fintechs compared to other sectors, and I'm reliably informed that in many cases, the VCs, having just mentioned VCs, the VCs actually prevent this happening. They don't want their influence diluted. Finally, ending up with Section 9, the hype of the hour is blockchain. We're still waiting for blockchain to actually do anything for anybody. I think for me, the most impressive intellectual thinking around this is that over 2016, the whole idea of blockchain, the infrastructure behind Bitcoin, has been utterly reversed from this kind of anarchic, decentralized system into a system which is now called distributed ledger technology in many cases, which is owned by a few strong incumbents. However, they're proving quite hard to find ways of cooperating or linking it with money and all these kind of things, so not much is happening there. Which brings me on to the exciting bit, which is what were my best fintechs of the year. But first, I'd like to thank all of you listeners. When I sit here and look at the statistics on my host, I see numbers and the numbers are going up. And that's all very pleasing, but somewhat impersonal. However, quite often when I do go to events, I get the chance to speak to many of you, and I'm very pleased to find that it is something that does add value, that something sort of educates and something that many of you appreciate. So I'd like to thank each and every one of you, even though at over 4,000, something like 4,400 listeners for the John Kay episode, I really am unlikely to meet you all. I'm still appreciating you. Equally, I'm very appreciative of my brand partners who joined in 2016. Archiver, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital, business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 6,000 people, 16 countries and $400 million of revenue. So, let's just wrap up with the best fintechs of 2016, in my opinion. I'll explain why, and then move on a little to look at 2017 and what to watch there. Moving on to my award for best fintech of the year. This is jointly given to two companies. I couldn't choose between them. Blue Motor Finance has gone from 12 to 100 staff, 0 to 40 people on the road, 0 to over £200 million of loans, and 0 to seven-figure profits in just 2 years. A phenomenal achievement and by a firm not widely known in the broader fintech world. The main problem for fintech in London at the moment, or in the UK as a whole, is a lack of profits. Blue Motor Finance have solved that, certainly at the moment, and Bob Jones, their charismatic chief executive, who's at 75, by far the oldest person I've had on the show, has shared in LFP066 the secrets of 50 years as chief executive of big companies and now of a small company and how to achieve that. So I'd like to give thanks to him and my credit to them. Joint winner with Blue Motor Corp Group are my sponsors, Smart Pension. And I haven't put them there because they're my sponsors, because actually, picking one sponsor is going to cause more trouble than not picking a sponsor. But Smart Pension I've chosen because they're surely the most successful of all fintechs in the UK in terms of client gathering. And in a couple of years, in the workplace auto-enrolment pensions world, they've gone from zero to a phenomenal 120,000 clients. My purpose in highlighting these two great firms is to show you that even if it's next to impossible to create a startup and turn into a scale-up, even if the scale-ups start running into regulatory difficulties and find that it's all a bit more complicated than you think, it is still possible in the world at the moment, and this is more possible now than ever, to create a truly amazing achievement. So I'd like to appreciate Blue Motor Group and Smart Pension's amazing achievement of making millions of profits and getting six-figure clients, both of which in 2 years. So turning to 2017, if FinTech 1.0, kind of like Athena, emerged from the waves fully clad, FinTech 2.0 is perhaps a response to the changes in regulation. The principal two areas that I'm looking to are payments and banking. in payments. Access to the payments systems is being broadened. The most fascinating factoid for me in 2016 about payments was nothing to do with fintechs, nothing to do with banks or insurance companies, but was rather that one of the UK's largest retailers is looking at joining the payment system itself. Now that's fascinating. Imagine if you're a bank and you're in the business of payments, or you're a non-bank and you're in the business of payments, and one of your biggest clients in the UK suddenly bypasses you and kind of does payments directly and does it using its own loyalty cards and this kind of thing. That's a huge revenue loss. So that's something which is potentially of macroeconomic importance. If clients start disintermediating the banks, then that really is of significance. This makes me reflect on fintech as a whole. Fintech, as I've always said, has meant many things to many people, and in particular probably means nothing very precise. But going forwards, fintech, I think, is best seen as how the world at large is changing how it uses financial services. I'll come on in a minute to how I've slightly changed how I'm using financial services. But it applies literally from the likes of me to the largest retailer in the UK. We're all actually able to use financial services in a different way, in a way that hopefully is easier, better, faster, cheaper, more fun, you name it. Banking is the second area of FinTech 2.0. We've got the open banking initiatives, we've got APIs. I've seen a lot of scepticism, probably quite realistic and justifiable, around how well this will work. After all, it's going to be very hard for regulation to tell banks how good their APIs must be, where they expose internal client data and all that kind of stuff. And as anybody in tech knows, a bad API is more trouble than it's worth. A subset of the open banking is the SME referral scheme in the UK, which finally started after, again, another sort of couple of years of being in the works. It's a little embargoed at the moment over how well that's going, but as soon as we find out, I will let you know. In terms of banking reforming or being refactored or rethought, then a commendation goes to Monzo, who narrowly missed out on the best fintech of the year in 2017, as they only got some 80,000 plus clients from a standing start, although over a shorter period than Smart Pension. However, to Monzo, I'd like to give my These Are the One to Watch for 2017 award. In LFP 067, I was pleased to talk to Tom about his model of banking, as I'd never quite understood how this applies. Banking, to me, involves two things. It involves the ability to create money literally out of thin air, and also to transform maturities, but Monzo never seemed too interested in either. And coming out of that episode, I came away with a different model than I had before, and I hope many of you had too, of banking as a kind of wrapper, as opposed to banking as an identity. If you're a bank as an identity, then you're in the business of creating credit and doing maturity transformation. If you're in banking as a wrapper, then it's merely a way to use existing constructs, regulatory constructs, of course, but also regulatory abilities like accessing the payment system, to be recognised in a known form. It's much easier to go to journalists, as Tom said, and say, oh, we're going to become a bank, than it is to go there and say, we're going to become a new model of consumer financial support. As I mentioned on the show, it's the one fintech that I've actually got round to using in any great depth, and I found it really cool and actually far more helpful than I thought, and especially given their expansion plans, there's all sorts of interesting things that could take place in 2017. So let's put some chips on then. And finally, when I get to this end of the show, the thing that might amaze you listeners to know is that by and large, of the dozens and dozens and dozens of guests I've had in the show, they cope with everything really well until I get to the end and say, OK, well, now you can say whatever you want. At which point a lot of them struggle. And increasingly, I've just taken to saying to them, well, look, why don't you tell the world what you want? Because who knows, someone out there listening may have what you want and may bring it to you. So they all take that and come back to Monzo. I think Tom was talking about wanting a head of partnerships, which is a fantastic role. So let me apply the same advice to myself. So what does the future hold for me? Well, in terms of the podcast, the good news is that the sector keeps changing. There are plenty of smart cookies out there to find for the show. But it is a real search job, and I think it's no coincidence that the jointly shared London FinTech Podcast FinTech of the Year Award for 2016 went to two firms that almost no one has ever heard of. To flip it round the other way, is it actually a surprise that those who spend so much effort creating a media image, be it mainstream or alternative or social media image, and generally flouncing around, have a smaller percentage of their time left for creating true lasting value? In terms of myself, I was rather shocked recently when a long-term listener to the show said to me, "Oh, by the way, what do you do, Mike, when you're not doing the podcast?" I thought, oh dear. So much for my marketing and sales ability. Well, I've been an independent consultant now for 19 years. Time flies, doesn't it, when you're having fun? So I do consultancy. I do media work in terms of chairing and moderating and presenting and writing for public events and for private events. And I also operate as an advisor and non-executive. So again, if any of you listeners know of any lines to folks who've got consultancy needs or media needs or advisory needs, contact needs, as we're talking about in the VCs, then please point them in my direction. At which point, I'm greatly looking forward to next week's episode, as I can leave all the hard work of having something to say to the guest, who I can just question, as opposed to questioning myself. And I'd love to wish you all a very happy new year, and I hope that 2017 is a fantastic one for you and yours, and I hope that we don't all get ground down by this apparently turnkey fascism and ever-intrusive state. Finally, to end on one of the big laughs of last year, the Snoopers Charter in the UK, which has now been ruled illegal by the EU. Fortunately, we're still in the EU at the moment for this context. My laugh came when I saw in the newspaper that, of course, the MPs exempted themselves from it. You're not allowed to snoop on MPs. They can snoop on every other member of the population. Just shows whoever you give power to, you can't really trust it. Live long and prosper. Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. Like the mountains and the trees, can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.